will lose your money. If you deviate from your plan, you are playing with a lighted fuse. Sure, the bomb may not go off in any particular battle, but before the war is over, the bomb will explode in your face. What if? Robinson's comment about making the wrong move at the right time is another way of saying deviating from the plan and basing your decision on a hunch, feeling, or intuition. It's like taking a multiple-choice test in school, not knowing the answer, and going with your gut. It's like the time Conrad doubled his bet at the baccarat table because he got a feeling that we were going to get a run. The market is no place for making the wrong move at the right time. Any deviation from your plan triggers the potential for losses due to psychological factors. It cannot be emphasized enough how important it is for you to stick to your plan. If you get nothing else from this book except the acknowledgement that you need a plan, then at least you'll know when you're deviating. At least you will know that you are deviating from something, whereas prior to listening to this book, you would not have known. However, you also cannot ignore the fact that even after listening to this book, at some point in the future, you will deviate from your plan and break the rules. Even though the following advice may seem to contradict everything this book has said about the need for a plan, I would be remiss if I didn't give you this final lesson about the markets, because I know you're human, and I know you will deviate. If you deviate from your plan, break the rules, follow a tip, act on some intuition or gut feel, remember this. Capital S speculating, and this includes investing and trading, is the only human endeavor in which what feels good is the right thing to do. We all know we shouldn't smoke. A lot of us still do. We know we shouldn't drink. A lot of us still do. We know we shouldn't drive over the speed limit. A lot of us do. Why do we do all these things that are not good for us and that we know are not good for us? Well, because they feel good. It feels good to drink and smoke and drive fast. But ever since we were little kids, we have been told not to do things that feel good. When it comes to the markets, you're supposed to do what feels good. If you deviate from your plan and the market starts going against you, what are you going to say when I knock on your door and ask, "Well, are you having fun? Is this an enjoyable experience?" You're going to say, "No, this is not fun. Looking at these prices going down is not fun." You know what you should do? Don't go looking for supporting evidence or reasons to stay in the market. Do what feels good. Get out. There is an inverse relationship between your threshold of pain and success in the markets. So as soon as you feel the pain, get out. What if you have on a long position and prices are going up? Does that feel good? Do you know what you're supposed to do? Keep feeling good. Leave it alone. It's working fine. Stay with positions that make you feel good. Get out of positions that make you feel bad. You'll know when you feel bad. If you can recognize anything, you will recognize this doesn't feel good. The minute it doesn't feel good, stop doing it. It's that simple. Postscript. In the preface, we saw that Henry Ford personalized his successes and lost nearly $1 billion by following his opinions to the bitter end. But Henry Ford wasn't the only business person who personalized his successes and then suffered a huge loss. Sir Freddie Laker, the British entrepreneur, started a no-frills transatlantic airline service, SkyTrain, in 1977. Laker's story is the classic one of a factory tea boy who, through hard work and effort, turned himself into a jet-setting millionaire. In order to achieve fortune and fame, he had taken on both the U.S. and British governments and the International Air Transport Association, the International Airline Cartel. Granted, the service was only across the North Atlantic, but it would spread to all routes, wouldn't it? All this warrior had to do was take on those representatives of the establishment a few more times. A combination of factors, including adverse currency movements and the U.S. government grounding of all DC-10 airplanes in 1979, right at the start of the peak holiday traffic season, began to strain Lakers' financial situation. As the storm clouds gathered around Laker Airways, Laker dismissed the idea that he was under severe financial strain. "No, I am not bust." Sound like denial to you? He maintained this position even after it became obvious that the airline would not be able to meet the $48 million repayment of interest and principal needed between September 1981 and March 1982. Offensively, Laker told the bankers that he was going to teach them their jobs. "I have innovated in aviation, now I must innovate in banking," he boasted. Sound like emotionalism? That is, the prestige in a crowd decision? Right up until the last minute, Sir Freddie Laker maintained that all was going to turn out satisfactorily. His airline was not going to go broke. But it wasn't to be. On Thursday, February 4th, 1982, at 8 a.m., the receivers were called in. Also, consider the case of personal computer pioneer and whiz kid Steve Jobs. With no formal training in computing, Jobs divined the shape of things to come. His once unconventional ideas, which foresaw the personal computer revolution, proved prescient. After creating Apple II, the first wildly successful and popular personal computer, Jobs led and inspired the team that created the most acclaimed PC, the Macintosh. His faith in his own genius, as the Wall Street Journal called it, which served him well at Apple, helped precipitate his fall from a very lofty perch when he started his subsequent computer company, Next. He ignored advisors' repeated warnings about flaws in Next's strategy and stuck tenaciously to his vision. This time, however, Jobs' vision proved flawed. Next has never turned a net profit and has exhausted $250 million from backers. As a final example, look at the story of Roy Raymond, who started the highly successful chain of seductive and elegant lingerie stores, Victoria's Secret. In 1982, he sold the business to The Limited for $2 million. Says a friend of Mr. Raymond's, "Roy had that feeling that he was bulletproof and that whatever he touched would turn to gold." His next endeavor was an upscale children's clothing store, which plunged him into bankruptcy proceedings. Each of these men personalized his successes and began to believe he would only ever have success. On the other hand, consider Roberto Goizueta, CEO of Coca-Cola. When Goizueta became president in 1981, he created a strategy for the 1980s, which spelled out his intention to diversify Coca-Cola into services that complement our product lines and that are compatible with our consumer image. Few people, including the media, took him seriously. Then in 1983, Coke purchased Columbia Pictures. People were aghast. Financial analysts dumped on the deal, claiming Coke had paid too much, and besides, what did Coke know about making movies? Coke's stock dropped 10% within a few days. During the rest of that year, however, critics had to admit that Coke and Goizueta hadn't been so dumb after all. Columbia cranked out three smash hits in a row: Tootsie, Gandhi, and The Toy. Goizueta also introduced the idea of lending the magical Coke name to another soft drink, an idea most people at the company viewed as heretical. In fact, when a few daring men suggested the same idea in the early 1960s while developing Tab, then-CEO J. Paul Austin condemned them for it. 2 decades later, here was Austin's replacement proposing to lend the Coke name to a diet soft drink. Diet Coke was an instant phenomenon, surpassing all company expectations. By the end of 1983, Goizueta felt vindicated in the eyes of the world. Columbia, a money machine, earned $91 million in its first full year as a Coca-Cola subsidiary. In 1983, following hard on the heels of Diet Coke's unparalleled achievement, the company introduced caffeine-free versions of Coca-Cola, Diet Coke, and Tab. Goizueta proved that Coke could adapt, and once the giant stirred, it usually dominated a market segment. Goizueta's triumph intensified, dominating a 1983 spring issue of Business Week, being named by Adweek Marketer of the Year, and being praised by Dunn's Business Month for running one of America's five best-managed companies. It would seem that Roberto Goizueta had every reason for self-congratulation. Yet in 1983 he said, "There is a danger when a company is doing as well as we are. And that is to think that we can do no wrong. We can do wrong, and we can do wrong big." In 1985, Goizueta decided to change Coke's secret formula. He had been a chemist at Coke for many years, and the idea of changing the formula had been around for a long time. He announced the change to New Coke at a press conference on April 19, 1985. Goizueta called it the boldest single marketing move in the history of the packaged consumer goods business, and also the surest move ever made. There was immediate disapproval from the media and public. Business Week called the decision the marketing blunder of the decade, and many others agreed. But the ready, fire, aim philosophy had worked so far, and this audacious, bold move would prove Coca-Cola's leadership to any doubters. Is it possible Goizueta had personalized his previous successes? Was he experiencing the Midas touch syndrome? He had made several major decisions with which others disagreed, yet each time he had been proven right. Unlike Ford, Laker, Jobs, and Raymond, Goizueta didn't personalize his previous successes, so he was able to recognize and accept the loss. He didn't make the matter an issue of personal pride and choose to fight to the bitter end. He recognized it as a losing proposition to eliminate the original formula altogether. He cut his losses and moved on. He managed the situation brilliantly by reintroducing the original formula under the name Coca-Cola Classic and increased Coca-Cola's market share in the soft drink business in the process. Why was Goizueta able to avoid entering the trap that produces the fatal errors? Was it because managers are exempt from this pitfall? No. We'll see shortly that managers are quite susceptible. Did Ford, Raymond, and the others succumb because they were entrepreneurs, and entrepreneurs have difficulty going on to be managers? No. There are numerous cases of the founding entrepreneur going on to successfully manage the company. For example, Fred Smith at Federal Express, William McGowan at MCI Communications, Bill Gates at Microsoft. So what was it that separated Goizueta from the others? They fell into a category aptly described by William Salmon, professor of business administration, Harvard Business School, this way. "I've seen people who have been at a certain place at a certain point in time with a good idea and did fabulously well, and they haven't a clue about what to do next. They're not good advisors, and they're not repeat entrepreneurs. And there's a process of assuming, based on what you've succeeded in doing in the past, that you're a genius." The process Salmon is referring to is the process of personalizing successes as explained in this book. Goizueta avoided the process, and the others didn't. He didn't equate his personal worth with whether or not his idea was successful. He distinguished external successes and losses from internal ones, and he didn't personalize his previous accomplishments. He knew the difference between being right and doing right, and he avoided emotionalism. That's what sets the successful decision-maker apart from the not-so-successful. Even though Goizueta was primarily a manager and the others were primarily entrepreneurs, they were all in the business of making decisions, the goal of which is the profits of managing risk, not the ego gratification of being right. Remember, you don't get any money just because you know why the market is going up or down. You only get money if your plan has positioned you to capitalize on the market's movement, regardless of whether you know why the market is up or down on a particular day. Harvard Business Review, the Bible of management theory, says, "An essential quality needed by a good salesman is a particular kind of ego drive which makes him want to make the sale in a personal or ego way, not merely for the money to be gained. His self-picture improves dramatically by virtue of making the sale and diminishes with failure." It is precisely this quality which is so detrimental to a capital S speculator and any other type of decision maker. Realizing this helped me understand why I was able to make so much money as a salesman, yet couldn't make a dime as a trader. Remember my futile efforts to make all the money back and the realization I had about having never been a trader? I had been a good salesman and at the right place at the right time, not a trader. This doesn't mean salespeople can't be traders, and it doesn't mean salespeople can't be managers or entrepreneurs. But it does mean that given a salesperson's, that is, a broker's, motivation, he needs to have a plan that will prevent the market position or his client's position from becoming personalized, the way I personalized my client's losses after I blew up the Cleveland office. The ego drive of a salesperson may also explain why salespeople have a reputation for being lousy traders. How so? A salesperson's goal is to make the sale, to be right by countering objections and negative feedback from the prospect. But the capital S speculator's goal is to make money, not to be right or counter the negative feedback from the market. A salesperson's ego gratification from being right is precisely what the entrepreneur, capital S speculator, and manager must avoid. Tying one's self-picture to the success or failure of the business venture or market position means the individual will not want to acknowledge a loss when it occurs and will play out the pattern outlined in Chapter 9. This is true for all losses resulting from psychological factors, regardless of the scale of the loss in dollar terms, $1,000 or $1 million, or the venue in which the loss takes place, in the markets or in other lines of business. For instance, a 1989 study in the Journal of Accounting Research concluded that managers are reluctant to give up on projects they begin because to do so would convey a negative signal about their ability. Moreover, a manager might not choose to sell the assets because the potential sale would convey negative information about him personally. The study also found that when such a manager was replaced, his replacement, who does not care about the first manager's reputation, would have no such reason for holding on to the assets and will tend to sell them relatively quickly. The replacement manager was able to be objective. His predecessor wasn't. What does this tell you? Managers and corporate executives can become too attached to a project and personalize it, and they are susceptible to the losses due to psychological factors, just like capital S speculators are when they personalize market positions. What you have to understand as a capital S speculator, entrepreneur, or manager is that there is a fine line between perseverance because you think the idea is a good one and perseverance because you think the idea is a good one. The former is objective, the latter is subjective, and often follows personalizing previous successes. In the first case, you arrived at the decision deductively after examining the evidence. The decision is supported by the facts, and you have a pragmatic exit discipline, a defined set of circumstances that will cause you to determine the idea is no longer a good one because the evidence no longer supports the original decision. In the second case, the decision is made first. With no exit strategy, you inductively seek evidence that will support the decision. In the former, your thinking is used to explore possibilities, and you arrive at a conclusion by default. In the latter, your thinking is used to defend a previously expressed opinion and to protect your ego, which is attached to that opinion. If you didn't understand the distinction about the perseverance mentioned above, you might think all you had to do to be a successful entrepreneur was believe in your idea and take on the risk of carrying it out. After all, that's what entrepreneurs do, right? They take risks. Some of them take seemingly huge risks, so huge that entrepreneurs are often compared to daredevils. But are they actually seeking risks? Look at Scott Schmidt, the entrepreneur who popularized what has become known as extreme skiing. Schmidt jumps from 60-foot cliffs for a living. Ski equipment companies sponsor him, and people make videos of his jumps. From the chairlift, he appears a reckless maniac. But for every jump, he has carefully charted the takeoff point and landing. His pioneering work has broken a path for an industry of extreme skiers, some of whom have been more reckless and died. Schmidt doesn't consider himself reckless. Given his approach, Schmidt isn't reckless. He charts, that is, plans his entry and exit to the jump. He doesn't seek risk. He seeks to reduce and manage risk. Look at self-made billionaire entrepreneur Craig McCaw. Despite any appearances to the contrary, Craig McCaw, founder and chairman of McCaw Cellular Communications, maintains that he and those at his company have always been risk-averse. And how did his approach to the business develop? From a game. Sound familiar? During early business trips and chess games with J. Elroy McCaw, his father, who was also an entrepreneur, Craig learned the concept of an exit strategy. Every deal we ever did had a back door. The public just didn't see the back doors. This is just another example of what this book has been saying about the need for a stop loss, that is, exit strategy, and of the benefits of applying the positive attributes of a game to the continuous process of business and the markets. What's true about the markets is also true for business in general. Just as there are many ways to make money in the markets, there are many ways to make money in business. Sam Walton made his money one way, and Gucci made his another. You can read through the annals of American business and see extraordinary variety in the personalities and methods among the best-known entrepreneurs and business people. They come in all shapes and sizes. Some were team efforts, others were individual. Some had a lot of money to get started, others did not. The differences go on and on. There is no single pattern to how the most successful entrepreneurs or the best managers in business make money. However, there is a common denominator among this group. Rather than just taking risks, as is commonly assumed, they excel at judging, minimizing, and controlling risks. Craig McCaw understood this. Did Steve Jobs? Over a period of 8 years, Next has consumed $250 million without producing a successful product or sustained profitability. What is the exit point? The original capital infusion from Ross Perot and Canon Incorporated was $125 million. Was it known then that the loss might go to $250 million? If so, fine. But if not, what's to keep it from going to $350 million? Managers of all businesses must be able to take losses. Alan Ace Greenberg, CEO of Bear Stearns, says, "The definition of a trader is a guy who takes losses." This is exactly the point made earlier about losses being a normal part of business, and that trying to avoid losses altogether by not taking them is a loser's curse. Bear Stearns has weekly cold sweat meetings in which traders are grilled about their positions. The firm tolerates losses, but not surprises. In one such meeting, a trader was asked about one of his positions and what the downside was. He outlined several scenarios and the losses associated with each. When the position started to deteriorate, the firm took the mounting losses, upward of $10 million, in stride. They were prepared for such an event. The losses never surpassed their stop-loss point, and the position soon turned around and made money. It is important to understand that they held on not because they wanted to look good, look smart, or be right. They held on because the position remained within previously defined and acceptable loss parameters. Remember, people participate in the markets, all markets, either to satisfy a need, that is, solve a problem, or to satisfy a want, that is, make them feel good. Managing risk solves a problem and should never be engaged in to feel good, look smart, or be right. In all risk-taking, capital S speculation, business ventures, entrepreneurial activities, it is the loss side on which you must focus first. This is even true for gambling. The gambler determines how much he's willing to bet and lose before the game is played. He doesn't wait for the game to end and then let the croupier or dealer assign his wager for him. How do you determine the downside, and how do you control or minimize it? With objective decision-making and a plan that has, as its starting point, the stop-loss parameters. Rather than looking for a formula for success to follow, this book has identified the formula for failure to avoid. As An Wang, founder of Wang Laboratories, said, "It is my belief that there are no secrets to success." The formula for failure is not lack of knowledge, brains, skill, or hard work, and it's not lack of luck. It's personalizing losses, especially if preceded by a string of wins or profits. It's refusing to acknowledge and accept the reality of a loss when it starts to occur, because to do so would reflect negatively on you. Appendix. Jim Rogers formed one half, George Soros was the other half, of the phenomenally successful Soros Fund. During his tenure, 1969 through 1980, the fund was up 3,365% versus the S&P Composite's gain of 47%. Marty Schwartz is an independent professional trader. He attained a degree of fame from his performance in the U.S. Trading Championships. He entered 10 four-month contests, and in 9 of those contests, in one contest he broke even, he has made more money than all the other contestants combined, averaging 210% non-annualized return. John Templeton is the Dean of Global Investing. His investing record shows that for 31 years, his performance has averaged an annual increase of 15% versus 7% for the Standard & Poor's Index. He managed $6 billion for the Templeton funds before retiring. William O'Neill started in the securities business in 1958 as a stockbroker. During 1962-63, he pyramided $5,000 into $200,000 in 3 back-to-back trades. Eventually, he launched the Investor's Business Daily newspaper. Over the past 10 years, his investments have averaged a 40% annual return. Warren Buffett started Buffett Partnership at the age of 25 with $100,000. In 1969, when he liquidated the partnership at the speculative market peak, it had grown to $100 million. Buffett's take, $25 million. His investors earned 30 times their original investment. Today, he runs Berkshire Hathaway, and his investors continue to benefit from his stellar performance. His personal investing success is evidenced by his inclusion in the Forbes 400 with a personal net worth of $1 billion. P. Peter Lynch ran Fidelity Management's Magellan Fund, the largest mutual fund in history, from 1977 to 1990. Before retiring in January 1990, Lynch was one of the highest-paid portfolio investment employees in the world. $10,000 placed with Lynch in 1977 when he took over management of the fund grew to $200,000 in 1988. Paul Tudor Jones earned over $1 million in commissions in his second year in the business as a commodity broker. In 1980, he switched to the floor of the New York Cotton Exchange and made millions during the next few years. Each $1,000 invested with him as chairman of Tudor Investments in 1984 had grown to more than $17,000 by 1988. Michael Steinhardt has one of the best 20-year track records in investment history. $10,000 put in his hedge fund at its 1967 inception grew to over $1 million 20 years later, achieving a compounded annual growth rate of 30%. Over the same period, $10,000 invested in the Standard & Poor's 500 index grew to only $64,000. Roy Neuberger is chairman of Neuberger Berman & Company. He started as a runner on Wall Street in 1929, and when he began investing his own money a few years later, he took $30,000 to several hundred million. Bernard Baruch had made $3 million on Wall Street by the time he was 32 years old, and this was in the 1920s and 1930s. He made $1 million in the stock market and put it at risk to earn a second million and so on until he amassed $25 million. W.D. Gann was one of the most successful commodity and stock traders in the 1920s and 1930s, if not all time. An analysis of his trading record over 25 market days revealed that he made 286 trades, 264 of which were profitable. During that period, he turned $450 into $37,000. That concludes What I Learned Losing $1 Million by Jim Paul and Brendan Moynihan. Narrated by Patrick Lawler. Copyright 2013 by Brendan Moynihan. Production copyright 2014 by Tim Ferriss Audio.
I'm very excited to have Brendan Moynihan with us today. Brendan, how are you?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
Doing extremely well. And I am thrilled to be chatting with you because, of course, I was introduced to your work first through What I Learned Losing $1 Million. And I remember being introduced to it by N.N. Taleb, or Nassim Taleb, who wrote, of course, Anti-Fragile, then before that, The Black Swan, and then Fooled by Randomness. And one of the lines that stuck out in his most recent book about What I Learned Losing $1 Million was that it was one of the rare non-charlatanic, if that's the correct pronunciation, books in finance. And I was hoping, before we jump into all sorts of other questions that I'd like to ask, why do you think he said that? Why do you think he used that particular adjective?
I don't know. I had never met him when he put the title of my book in The Black Swan. And at that time, he said it was the best non-charlatanic finance book he'd ever read. Mm-hmm. And it was actually that mention that caused a little bit of a stir with email for me to reprint the book. So I reprinted the book based on what happened in The Black Swan. Mm-hmm. And then a few years later, he was at an interview with a dozen or so journalists at Bloomberg News. And I happened to be a consultant there at the time. And they invited me to sit in on a lunch. And he recognized my name when I was introduced just because he had put it in his book. So I never really queried him about, I was thankful that he did it because he's not known for handing out compliments. So I was just happy to have had it, and I wasn't going to jinx it. But we had a very interesting discussion while we were in that room, and it turns out that he's read a lot of the same things that I've read, and so it was sort of a dialogue between him and me while the reporters were kind of taking notes, which is very interesting. So I don't know why he did that, but I think that it's because it was an opposite tact, in that there's so many books out there on how I made $1 million in the stock market last year before breakfast, and in the $1 million book that I wrote, I even go back to try to find out how old is this. And there's a book from like 1881, I think, by James Briskin called The Beef Bonanza, How to Get Rich on the Plains. You know, I mean, it wasn't the stock market. I guess it was a livestock market. But people have been forever like, I'm going to tell you my secrets of how I got rich. I don't understand that. So I titled this book, What I Learned Losing $1 Million, with my co-author. Again, Jim lost the money, not me. I want to be clear about that. Mm-hmm. But why would somebody reveal their secrets to making it? Why don't we examine what goes wrong? And then if somebody's willing to bare their soul about that and share the mistakes, mm-hmm. then as a parable, it might have more resonance with people about what not to do rather than what to do. And I think there's I'll get into it later, but I think there's a real premise for why it's essential to know the downside rather than all the different ways to make it on the upside.
Well, I think that we should, of course, explore that. And I think that it's funny when you pointed out, you know, the getting rich on the plains with the beef bonanza, because I can imagine for every given market, there's probably an equivalent book. I'd imagine if you go back to Venice or if you go to
one for the tulip mania.
Right, the tulip mania. I was just going to bring up the tulip mania. There's probably some type of handbook that people were selling at the time. And what does that indicate as a problem or deficiency with those guides? What makes them charlatans in some cases, not in all cases, but in some cases? What do you think the problems are inherent in such a book?
Yeah. Well, Taleb put the label on there, so I don't necessarily want to, you know, speak to what his view or perspective was on that. But from what I understand, it's that people are holding themselves out as experts with some sort of specialized knowledge or insight mm-hmm. that as a high priest class, only they can impart to other people. And there were people who made livelihoods throughout history mm-hmm. by being hucksters or tricksters or charlatans. And I think that from my understanding of reading Taleb's work, that he thinks that there is a large cottage industry in the financial services industry that does that. They forecast what the market's going to do or what the economy is going to do. They tell people what they should do with their money, or they reveal inside secrets. And I think that he said, you know, if you try to do those or you try to follow those, you might get lucky for a while, but you have to understand that was luck. It was not some special secret formula that you had or got from this person to bring you to that state. So,
right.
But yeah, no, I think you're right. It happens in every industry. So,
and I think, you know, I've found investing fascinating for so long. When I say investing, it was generally for most people listening to this, that would mean publicly traded equities, for instance, stocks. And I remember the very first stock I ever bought. I don't know if I've ever publicly talked about this. This is my story, of course, not yours. But and I want to talk about your background in a second. But the very first stock I bought was Pixar. And I was 15 or 16 years old. And it was
probably the early 90s.
Yeah, it was 95, perhaps 96, I want to say, somewhere in that range, roughly. And I was thoroughly convinced the stock would do well, and it ended up doing well, but I didn't have the emotional control to hold it. So I sold way too early. And what's funny about it is I then went and tried to develop very sophisticated approaches while going to undergrad at Princeton and beyond, very sophisticated approaches to investing. And I've come full circle to where what made me believe in Pixar is what in some cases enables me to pick startups that I believe in. And it's just funny how I tried to copy these models that seem to me very sophisticated. And there are some sophisticated models, of course, but there's such a survivorship bias in finance where you have 100 people perhaps who roll the dice. And there are people who don't just roll the dice, but 100 people who roll the dice, and you have the few who survive are the people you hear about, which is also true of, say, startup icons who end up on the covers of magazines after risking it all. And it's a skewed data set. It's a really skewed data set. But I don't want to digress too far.
And you could say the same thing about the S&P 500, which everybody believes is a stock index we've had for, you know, since 1928, but it's not true. You know, it was created in 1957 on March 4th, and before that it was a 90 stock index. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 10 years ago, 40% of the stocks that are in it now were not even in it. And if you go back 20 years, like 80% of the stocks that are in it now weren't in it. So, I mean, even the gauge by which people are measuring, one, how the market performs, and then how managers perform against that mm-hmm. is like, you know, an elastic measuring tool. It's a rubber band. It's not a fixed set.
Right, exactly. And I think that what's also very common, and then I want to come back and give some background on you for people who may not be familiar with your background and credentials, but it's very common in the financial markets or any type of investing. I see this a lot in startups where someone will, just as a haphazard scattershot approach, invest in, say, 100 companies. And they happen to hit the Google of that decade, and then they paint the bullseye after the arrow has hit. And they attribute that to skill as opposed to luck. And then what's so ironic about that in Silicon Valley, at least, is that they then get a reputation, assuming they can use PR and messaging well enough, for being a good investor, and they start to see better deals, which then becomes this self-perpetuating cycle until the hubris leads to something like massive overspending for a period of 4 or 5 years, and then they crater. But they create another fund, and then it's back to square one, which I think also happens quite a bit in hedge funds. But for those people who aren't familiar with your background, perhaps you could just tell us a little bit about your history and what led you up to what I learned losing $1 million, but also up to the current day.
Well, it's not an elaborate background. I was raised in Alabama, and I had the good fortune to one day in my senior year have Jim Rogers, who had started Quantum Soros Fund.
Mm-hmm.
He's from Demopolis, Alabama. I was from Birmingham. He came and spoke to our senior class, I think out of his fealty toward the state and coming to visit. And I was at the University of Alabama, so he came and spoke. And after class, I went up and collared him and said, okay, you know, you're a poor boy from Alabama and got to New York. How do I do it? So he said, well, I'm in town tonight if you want to go to dinner. So I went and had dinner with Jim Rogers when I was still a senior in college. I mean, I was already sort of determined that this is the industry I was going to get into, but I thought I got to take advantage of this guy being on the premises to talk to him. So, you know, I learned a little bit from him and struck up a bit of a dialogue. And way back then, when there were wood-burning computers and there was no World Wide Web, I wrote to him and he wrote to me, or I called him and he called me. And that kind of got me started. I interned when I was in college at a regional investment bank, and then I went to work for them for the first year after school. That was in Nashville, but I wanted to get to Chicago or New York, and I decided on Chicago for the futures market. So I went to Chicago. I spent 4 years there. I learned from a pretty smart guy there who'd been around for a long time, and kind of continued my real-world education rather than going to graduate school. And I got married, had my first son, and wound up working for a guy named Jim Paul for the last year that I was in Chicago. And I had gotten recruited back to Nashville, and it was at that lunch with Jim on my last day of working for him. I was in the Futures Research Department at Dean Witter, and the last day of my employ with him, he took me to lunch, and he told me the story about, or part of the story about how he'd lost the money. And, you know, he said, somebody said I should write a book about it. And I said, well, you know what? I can do it. I can take your flowery story and marry it with my dry theory. And that was May 31st, 1990. So that was sowing the seeds to do the book.
Now, you have an incredible, just as a side note, memory for dates. Has that always been the case? And I think you may have mentioned this before, but do you just have a particularly acute memory for facts and figures and things of that type?
Yeah, I'm not so good with names, but for some reason the 10 digits aren't as much of a challenge in their combination. So I don't know. I mean, there's some dates I can remember certain things, or certain things strike me as important, and so I remember them. And there are other things that go in one ear and out the other.
You had that meeting with Jim and proposed that you could make this book a reality. And how did the book then get written? What did that look like?
Because it was a lunch. So it was an hour, right? I mean, he just told me kind of the highlights and said, you know, somebody said I should write a book. I said, well, I can do that. I said, if you will tell the story to someone who hasn't heard it before so that you will be animated and, you know, full of inflection and just tape record it, send me the tapes, and then I will transcribe it and I will match it in with my theory. And I told him what my theory was, and I'd worked for him, so he was a little bit familiar with what my approach was. So that was May 31st, and then the beginning of November, he calls me and says, you know, oh, I can't do it. I can't talk to anybody, so I'm going to mail you a plane ticket, and you're going to fly up here and stay with me for a weekend, and I'm going to tell you the story. I'm like, all right, great. So the weekend before Thanksgiving in 1990, on a Friday, I flew up to Chicago. He picked me up at the airport. We went to the house, got there at, I don't know, 5, 6 o'clock or something, and his wife said, gentlemen, I lived this once. I'm not going to live through it again. I'm going to my sister's. I will see you on Sunday. And she left. So then Jim like turns on a Kentucky basketball game or something. And I don't really follow sports. So that was kind of like, okay, I'm going to burn 2 hours here, like, you know, doing nothing. I don't really really care about this, but so Jim watches the basketball game, and I'm like, okay, great. You know, I'm like, okay, I'm ready to get started. And he goes, no, let's watch a movie. So he puts in this movie called Pretty Woman. Well, I don't really watch movies. So I'm like, I'd never seen this thing. I didn't know what it was all about. So I sit there for like another, you know, I don't know how long that was, 2 hours, another 2 hours of my life I was never going to get back. So we get to the end of the thing, and I turn, Jim is 50 years old at this time. I turn and look, and the guy is sobbing. He has seen the movie before, okay, and he's sobbing at the final scene of this thing where the guy shows up.
Richard Gere.
Car, like, it's supposedly like he's riding a horse and carrying flowers and coming to get this girl or something. I was like, you got to be kidding me. So anyway, I'm like, okay, can we get started in the morning? So we got started in the morning. I had the tape recorder, had all the tapes, had extra batteries, ready to go. This is just a little dictaphone. You know, it's like the size of a, you know, a business card, a little bit larger or whatever. And Jim goes to the pantry and pours himself a screwdriver. This is 8 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, well, I know Jim had sort of mentioned, like when we went to lunch that day, he was like, oh, I think I'll have a drink. And I'm like, okay, it's lunchtime and you're going back to work. So, you know, Jim had a screwdriver then, and then Jim continued to drink screwdrivers and just talked into the tape recorder. Well, I asked a few questions here and there, but he basically was just doing a brain dump, and I was just going to transcribe it all later. So I don't know, maybe 3 in the afternoon, I kind of give in and say, okay, well, I'll have a beer. So I go to the refrigerator and have a beer, and I don't know, after about like an hour and a half of drinking beer, and he's drinking I don't know what by then, I'm feeling a little like woozy. I'm like, you know what, but you've been at this for 8 hours, you probably need a little rest, you know, you've been talking and drinking for 8 hours, and I probably need to put my head down too. this is not, you know, drinking beer in the middle of the afternoon is not something I really do. So I went, there was a guest room, so I go to the guest room. About half hour later, he comes in, banging on the door. He goes, Brendan, we're in big trouble. We're supposed to meet Pat for dinner in 30 minutes, and we've got to leave right now if we're going to make it. No, you may be in big trouble, but I'm not in big trouble. I'm not going anywhere until this room stops spinning, and it's not going to be anytime, you know, soon. So you go have dinner with Pat if you want, but I'm not leaving. So that was it for the night. I mean, we got 8 hours that day, and then we did probably another 9 hours the next day. I wound up with 17 hours worth of tape that I took back with me, all little micro cassettes. And then I spent Thanksgiving Day, when I wasn't at the turkey dinner, in the office, which was closed, using the secretary's headphones and dictaphone machine where you put the tapes in,
mm-hmm.
and then you use foot pedals and you fast forward and rewind, mm-hmm. and I started transcribing this thing. And then I started spending weekends transcribing it. And I'd never typed, you know, before in my life, so I basically used the Columbus method, you know, hunt, seek, and land to type this thing out.
My God, that sounds like a really long process.
It was, and you know, it was on a UNIVAC system. Again, there were wood-burning computers. There were no desktop computers at this place. We're talking about, you know, 1990. I'm sure they existed somewhere, but they didn't exist at this place.
Right.
So then, you know, I took my stuff and started tapping it out on the weekends, and then I started doing nights where I'd work all day, go home, have dinner, put the kids to bed, go back down to the office, work on the computer, adding to it. And it took the better, I mean, between the research and the writing and the back and forth and figuring out how I was going to organize it, it took me the better part of 3 years, 4 years to really kind of get it all into shape. You know, I don't know if you want to be bored with the details of, I mean, that was the writing side of it. The mm-hmm. production side was a little interesting as well. So, because we did it differently.
Well, let's talk about it. Yeah. Tell me about it. As a side note, maybe you can answer this at the same time. That is a major undertaking, of course, taking 3-4 years to do that. I'd be curious also just to hear, and you don't have to do it right now, but perhaps somewhere in your answer, what was the drive to do it? Why did you want to do this book?
Well, I think I've learned since then, because I've written several since, that just sometimes it's like something gets into your head and you got to get it out. And, I mean, I don't know if it's, you know, I'm not an artist by any stretch. My mom was. I did a bit when I was younger, but I guess you get something in your head and, you know, artists have to kind of get it out. So each of the subsequent books that I did kind of follow the same pattern where it's like I had this observation, I have something to say about it, I got to figure out the best way to say it, and then I want to create a physical product out of it and then, you know, try to sell it. I mean, it's mm-hmm. like, you know, we were trying to make a fortune off of Jim's misfortune, and, you know, we didn't necessarily, but it's not a bad business card. You know, we hand it out and, you know, it works. So, mm-hmm. but in the course of doing the book, I found out that, you know, the author really doesn't get that much money unless you're like, you know, a really big hitter and you get an advance and it's a great book and blah, blah, blah. I mean, there are a lot of middlemen in between, from the publisher to the bookstore to whatever, mm-hmm. To the person who gets paid to, you know, do the indexing on the book, you know,
sure.
they're getting as much as I was or something. I'm like, really? I mean, I wrote the book. So I decided that we're going to self-publish it. I wrote a letter with a 5-page synopsis of the book and a full copy of the manuscript and a self-addressed stamped envelope and sent it out to about 30 people of name in the industry, including Warren Buffett, who wrote back and said, "Sorry, Mr. Moynihan, too many requests, too little time, Warren Buffett." But I got his autograph, nothing else. Right? So we collected quite a few people. Ned Davis runs Ned Davis Research out of Florida, and Ned put his name on the back cover. Bob Prechter, you know, from the futures industry, did. Leo Melamed, chairman emeritus of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Ken Fisher, out in your neck of the woods, put a blurb on the back cover of the book. So we wound up with a pretty good list of, you know, 8 or 10 people of some name who were willing to read the book and, you know, put a blurb on it. Mm-hmm. And then we just got really lucky. I sent out maybe 20 or 30 made-up press releases. I didn't even know what a press release was, but I created one or, you know, looked at one and just made the same thing. So I sent them off to some of the news organizations, and Mark Hulbert at Forbes magazine picked up on it. Mm-hmm. And the day we self-published the book, October 5th, 1994, it made a byline on the cover of Forbes magazine above Jack Welch's head that says, "Biggest mistakes investors make, are you guilty?" And bang, we were done. We broke even in 3 months, and then we just had books to give away, and we sold the German rights, and, you know, then we were just kind of off to the races. So.
Germany's huge. Germany's a big market. And were you selling it at that point? I'm just trying to put a finger on the date.
1-800-something-BOOK. I mean,
CEO Reed or one?
I had P.O. Box 198038, Nashville, Tennessee. People were sending in checks. I'd go down there every day, get the checks, go home, box up books, mail them out. I mean, it was insane. You know, and then Jim would give speeches in the futures industry, and, you know, he'd take a box of books and he'd like sell them one by one. And I mean, it was not our job. We were just, but we got all the money. You know what right. I mean? It's like we weren't taking. It wasn't like there was a cut, but it was a hobby. You know, I don't play golf or tennis, so it's like this is what I do with my time. So.
And what did Jim look like? I'm trying to identify when he's sitting there having those screwdrivers. What is he wearing? What does
Jim
he look like?
Jim was 6'1", 6'2", probably 170, 175 pounds, lean, angular, may have been blonde, was starting to go a little bit gray, fair complexion, and a gravel voice from yelling in the lumber pit for, I don't know, 10, 15 years or something. I mean, his voice sounded like gravel in the bottom of an empty coffee can is what it sounded like.
Yeah, I felt like you did a good impersonation, at least based on my reading of the stories. That's the voice that I'm now going to have in my head when I reread it. What were some of the lessons that he learned or that you heard from him, stories and so on, that you weren't able to include in the book? Are there any other favorite Jim stories that just didn't make it into the narrative?
The stories were interesting. My view is that, you know, what I presented as the 3 mistakes that investors and traders make, it was an overarching perspective from what goes on between your ears that can screw up anybody's specific methodology for how they go about trying to make money. So I didn't think that, I thought I captured it, and then, you know, I buttressed it when I looked up the word psychology in the dictionary and I found out there's a 3-part definition that matches exactly the 3 parts that I just went through. So I'm like, okay, the light bulb went on over my head, and I went full bore to get that all worked in. I don't know that Jim really revealed anything to me that wasn't in there. I'll recount one thing that he said to me after I got him the manuscript and he read it. And he goes, "Okay, I know how you got all the story about me and all this." He goes, "But how do you know about all this law stuff and what goes on in your head?" And I thought, Jim, I told him, I said, "You're so vain. You think that, like, you're the only person who's lost money, okay? I mean, you know, I've lost money, okay? If I lost $15,000 on a trade or over a series of trades or whatever, it's not the same as much as you lost, but you know what? It's the same thing. I mean, you're not the only person who's done this." Okay, I get it. I understand. So I'm like, so I don't know that Jim was ever able to incorporate what I was saying into his approaches, because every once in a while, over the course of the 3.5 years that I was writing the book, he'd call and he'd say, "Oh, I did it again. I was up, and then I lost $20,000. I'm like, okay, well, Jim, I have a book for you to read. It's in manuscript form right now, but I'll be happy to send it to you that might help you with that problem, because you're obviously not getting it, you know? So I don't know that Jim ever really incorporated it into his psyche, and he may have been unable to. I don't know, but he had some hilarious stories, and, you know, some of them were recounted in the book. Some could not be recounted, you know.
For family programming.
You know, because the names would have to be changed to protect the innocent and all the rest. So, no, I think one of the funniest stories that, you know, I've ever heard came out of his mouth, and it was after he lost the money. So he's on the board of governors at the Mercantile Exchange. Okay? Mm-hmm. He's like in the executive committee. There are like six people making the decisions for the exchange. And he drops $1.6 million out of the $1.2 million that he has in 75 days.
Mm-hmm.
So they come in, liquidate the position, throw him off the board, and clear out his office.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, oops. So he goes downstairs to the same restaurant that he took me to have a lunch in all those years later. And he's like, you know, what am I going to do? And he says, well, you know, the only way to make good on this is I've got about $1 million worth of life insurance. And the only way to do that is for me to have a few drinks down here at the bar. Everybody knows I drink too much anyway. Then I'll take the Porsche, get out on the interstate out here, and heading home, I'll crank it up to about 100, and I'll aim the car at one of those concrete posts that holds up overhead bridges. So he goes downstairs, and he has his drinks, and he gets in the car, and he gets out on the interstate, and looks in the rearview mirror, and sees the blue lights flashing. So he pulls over, and the cop comes up to the window and says, license and registration, Mr. Paul. Does he have any idea how fast you were going? He goes, 85, 95. He goes, try 18 miles an hour. Get out of the car. So he was stuck in first gear. He was a road hazard, which is why he got pulled over, because he's in a car that looks like it's going fast when it's sitting still, and he's driving at 18 miles an hour in first gear. So he said it probably saved his life, and for what it's worth, I got a book out of it as well, but that quickly passed from his perspective. He's like, okay, I got saved by a guardian angel or something. I'm never going to do that again. And then he went about trying to, piece his life back together after that. But that was one of the funniest things I've heard from him.
And let me add another $15,000 of transmission damage to the amount of money I need to recoup.
Yeah, yeah.
On the three points that you mentioned, perhaps you could just give a brief mention of those three points. And in general, I'd be curious to hear what you think makes a good investor.
Okay. Well, the three points, and again, I kind of backed into it because I had the three things that I was doing wrong. I mean, I thought I had it kind of sorted out. And then I wrote the book, and then I realized, okay, this is really about a light treatise on the psychology of mistakes that we made. And I thought, well, what does psychology really mean? If I can work this into the book.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look up at the dictionary, it says, what are the mental processes, behavioral characteristics, and emotions of an individual or a group? So basically the mental processes are that people internalize what should be an external loss.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you lose your keys, you don't go through the five stages of internal loss, which is denial, anger, bargaining, depression, right? You lost your keys. It's no big deal.
Right, right.
When you lose money, people tend to internalize that, and they tend to equate self-worth with net worth.
Right.
And then they start going through this mental process. So being able to identify and capture that lets you know, okay, this is one of the mistakes that you could be making. You have now internalized something that should be external. Don't be doing this. This is a bad thing. Okay. I'm trying to abbreviate all this.
Obviously. Of course. Yeah, of course.
So the other one is the behavioral characteristics of, again, the individual or group. And I think that people mistake the venue in which they participate in an activity with the type of activity they're engaged in. In other words, mm-hmm. I think there are five types of market participants. I think there are investors, mm-hmm. speculators, traders, bettors, people who bet,
mm-hmm.
and gamblers.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on which one of those five you are is a function of how you're behaving in the environment. Mm-hmm. So there are people who can professionally gamble in Las Vegas and they have a system into whatever. So they're not really gambling. They've got some sort of system and methodology. And I don't do that kind mm-hmm. of stuff, but I've read enough about it to where there are people who do this. And oh, by the way, Edward Thorpe, an academic, wrote a book called Beat the Dealer,
mm-hmm.
made so much money that the Las Vegas Resorts and Hotel Association changed the rules of the game.
Mm-hmm.
So he went out and wrote a book called Beat the Dealer and sold 5 million copies. And I'm like, what is up with this?
Yeah.
This is like, the Beast Bonanza again, right? I mean, they changed the rules so they can't use this system, but 5 million people bought his book.
Yeah.
I'm like raising my hand. I got a book over here. I mean, I'll just sell 1 million. I don't need 5 million. Just come buy 1 million of it.
Just to touch on those labels that you mentioned, because I found one of the many eye-opening aspects of the book, because I think you got into at least a handful of those in the book, but how would you, in brief, distinguish those various classes, those five classes of market participants?
Investing, according to Adam Smith, is parting with capital with the expectation of return in the form of interest, rent, or dividends.
Mm-hmm.
Each of those three things are paid on a periodic basis, right? Quarterly, monthly, semi-annually, whatever.
Right.
You intend to be parted with that capital for an extended period of time.
Mm-hmm.
traders are market makers in my mind. They buy the bid and sell at the offer. It's all they do. They have to go home flat, and they are very short time frame oriented.
Mm-hmm.
Very different from the investor.
Mm-hmm.
Speculators buy and sell, go long or go short, not waiting for that dividend interest or rent. They are in for the short term, looking for the price differential, the price change. So their time frame is, again, different from the longer time frame of the investor. Bettors are interested in being right. You and I can have, there's not really a very politically correct, you know, term for this or updated term for this, but there's a thing called a gentleman's bet, right?
Right.
There's no money involved. This is bragging rights.
Like, you know, trading places.
I think this happened. You bet, they even bet a dollar, but if they took the dollar off the table, it'd be purely a gentleman's bet, right?
Right.
To where you get bragging rights. I was right, you were wrong, you know, and your chest puffs up and you get to make fun of the guy and, you know, whatever, right?
Right.
Or pinky bets, right? You know, you have a pinky bet. There's no money change, right?
Right.
They confuse